This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Vice President Mike Pence describes himself as a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order. In his new book, Piety and Power, author Tom LoBianco describes a man often caught in the tension between faith and ambition. How do those competing forces influence his life? And now, as vice president, the lives of Americans. We'll take your questions and comments on social media, from his career in Indiana politics to the White House. What do you want to know about Mike Pence? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Joining me now is Tom LoBianco, political journalist and author of Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Tom, it's great to have you here.
Thank you, Matt. It's awesome to be here. You know, when I was at the State House, Brandon Smith's shack was right next to mine.
You guys were neighbors.
We were neighbors.
State House reporter Brandon Smith, yes, for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Well, let's just start with the, shall we say, timely release of your book. An official impeachment inquiry began last week after a whistleblower's account of a phone call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine. If nothing else, when questions of impeachment arise, so does the question of who is the vice president again.
Oh, yeah.
So do you sense an increased interest in the vice president at the moment?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look, when we time this, I mean, a book process is incredibly intense, and you can't, you know, it's not a news story, right? You can't just time it on the button. We had no idea that it would be like this. The interest has picked up exponentially, although I should note, I think there would have been interest anyway, and I was kind of hoping, I mean, wrote a book, so I was hoping that, because he's unexplored. So even if the impeachment wasn't happening, Mike Pence as a figure in American history, as a powerful political person now, was largely unmapped terrain. And I mean, we know him around here in Indiana because he was the governor, been around a long time, political junkies. We understand generally about Mike Pence, but nobody had really gone deep on him yet and tried to get behind. I mean, what I wanted to do and what I hope we accomplished in the year is to find more of the human drive in things. And that's, and a lot of it I didn't see myself actually until I finished the book, because after you step back from sort of the thicket of anecdotes, I didn't know what the big takeaways are from it. And I guess I should state that I hope that different people see different things, right? I mean, that's reporting. You put it out there and let people make the decisions.
How long have you been covering Mike Pence?
Since 2011.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, you know, the funny thing is that when I moved out to Indiana, it was originally because Mitch Daniels was going to run for president and all eyes on Mitch. 3 weeks later, I drive down to Columbus, Indiana for the kickoff of Mike Pence's campaign for governor. And people would tell me occasionally, he did like a little media briefing at Zaharico's, a beautiful old ice cream shop, restored recently. He does like a media round table before the kickoff. All of us, Mary Beth Schneider was there, Nikki Kelly, Leslie Weidenbender, Brandon Smith. And then the next day he does the big campaign kickoff at the Columbus Commons. People would always tell me that Columbus is like this fascinating city. And I'm not from Indiana, but I just moved here like a month earlier. So I'm still trying to get my feet set. But everyone kept on telling me, they're like, look at Columbus, you know, dig into its history, understand this guy named Irwin Miller. And you know how it is day to day when you're a reporter, you're a journalist, you're putting together your show. You don't always have time to go deep on the stuff that you should understand. I did not seriously take the time to understand Irwin Miller and the history of Columbus until I started working on this book. And the more I found was that this place is incredible. You know, it's not like just, I mean, there are many one-stop towns sprinkled throughout Indiana, but this was more,
it's a mini metropolis.
It is. It really is. Yeah. We're here in Indy, you know, and everywhere has its own bubble. I grew up in Baltimore, and you know, people from Baltimore don't go down to D.C. It's the funniest thing in the world. It's only 40 minutes away. You know, beautiful Congress, Capitol, free museums, etc. People from Indy do not always leave Indy. Drive an hour south. Go spend some time down there. It's just gorgeous architecture, and it's a really cool city. It's fascinating.
So he was born and raised in Columbus. And can you tell us about his childhood? What was the family dynamic like?
He's a middle child, effectively, right? So there's four boys. Greg's the oldest. Then Edward Jr., the father is Edward Pence. And then Mike Pence is the third child. And then Tom Pence is the younger brother. So there's six siblings in total. And the way this works is that they kind of it's almost like a second family because they don't have the girls until 12 years later. Mm. So you have two girls. Mike Pence is more or less raised in that group of four boys. And, you know, he pointed out, when I was doing the research for this book, I loved reading these 1988 campaign articles that were being written. And a lot of folks that we know, a lot of people who are still active right now, Brian Francisco, Karen Terhune, John Shorg is at the House Democrats. He wrote a lot about Mike Pence back in the 1980s with the Columbus Republic newspaper. Mike Pence, the candidate, when he was 29 years old, late 20s, would give these incredible interviews. And he was very open about who he was as a person in a way that we don't see now. So I loved reading these old interviews. He talked about how in an interview with John Shore, he talks about how he was effectively a fat kid in high school. And I understand that. I was big myself in high school. All right. And, you know, you're more reserved. I get that. I understand that. I understand where he is at. Mike Pence refers to himself as, you know, the real pumpkin in the pickle patch. Right. And
these are his words.
Yeah.
This is how he felt.
Right. And, you know, that's the other thing, too. I should point this out. This is like I met some of his good friends this weekend as I was doing book events. And what everyone tells me is that Mike has this great sense of humor. And right. That's a great line. It's not like it's not dirty. It's not it's self-effacing. It's kind of perfect political humor. Right. It's really good. We never see that from him anymore. It doesn't, like, that part of him has evaporated over time. And that's natural. It comes with, you know, caution, rising up the ranks and whatnot. But anyway, so Mike Pence, he drops 55 pounds the summer after sophomore year of high school and comes back. And it's like he blossoms as a person in junior year of high school. He gets popular. He's more active in things. He had always been, you know, had a tight circle of friends. But that year, and that's where he starts getting into politics in a serious way, right? Runs for vice president of the student body, loses 1976, runs for president of the student government the next year and wins his senior year in high school. So by the time he leaves high school, he's a popular kid. He's going from the pumpkin in the pickle patch to the student president, popular kid. It's really fascinating.
So then he goes to Hanover College, a small liberal arts school in southern Indiana. You write about him. This was a time when he shifted from his Catholic roots to embracing a more evangelical Christianity. Mm-hmm. What's the story behind this shift?
Well, you know, the funny thing is I spent a lot of time researching religion and faith and practice outside of politics. I understand the politics. That's, you know, comes with time. But I needed to understand the theology and the practice of faith a little bit better to write this. You know, I want to say a big thank you to Matt Lewis, who your listeners probably know. He's a national a conservative commentator. He's at the Daily Beast. He helped me out a lot in understanding this. We would go to Bible study together. It's a Baptist church, and helped me kind of understand that world. I was raised Catholic.
As was I.
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
So I understand it.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, you know, look, they don't put Bibles in front of us. That's not part of the Vatican. That's not how they
catechisms.
Roll.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
So I'll start. And I should also thank Russ Pulliam too at the Indy Star, because Russ, who lives in both these worlds, he's a reporter and he's also an evangelical Christian, and he told me, he's like, Tom, if I was your editor, I would tell you to go read a whole gospel. Just read it front to back. Like, pick one. And he's like, just live in that for a little bit, right? You live in a state budget. You know, you understand how taxes work. You read the poll numbers. You see election returns. So go sit down with the Bible and, like, understand it. And it was really fascinating. For me, at least, this was the first time I seriously sat down with the Bible and tried to understand. And, I mean, it's fascinating the way that the different gospels treat the story of Jesus. To me, I started to understand a lot of cultural references better going back in the Old Testament and spending a little more time there. It was interesting.
Well, and you write that he often stops short of fully embracing the Christian rite.
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
Well, so once you understand his practice and his faith, you know, look, he moves from evangelical. He has this conversion experience in 1978. And I'm sorry, that was a very long way of answering your original question. He has his conversion experience in 1978, but he doesn't leave the Catholic Church until about 1994. He starts going to the Greenwood Community Church. It's a evangelical megachurch and non-denominational. That year, in that time in between, he's struggling with his faith and where he is. And this helps me understand why he's not totally embracing the Christian rite, why he's not a televangelist style evangelical, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, you know, et cetera. There's a lot of stuff that people have picked up on the book inside the book already. There's one place I would point out, and I think it's really interesting. It helps explain him as a person. I went and found his thesis that he wrote in 1980, December of 1980 at Hanover College. It's called The Religious Expressions of Abraham Lincoln. And understand where he is in his life in converting from Irish Catholic Democrat into a Christian and conservative and a Republican in that order. I mean, that is more or less the chronology of conversion, which is fascinating. He votes for Jimmy Carter, the evangelical in the race, in 1980, November of 1980. 1 month later, in George Curtis's class, he submits a thesis called The Religious Expressions of Abraham Lincoln. It is all about Abraham Lincoln's struggles with religion and the public sphere. But when you read that, you see, well, this is Mike Pence, 21 years old, senior in college. He's struggling with this. He's trying to figure out where he fits in. He's a human. Right, and when you get beyond the caricature, that's where everything starts to make sense.
Tom LoBianco, we appreciate you joining us today. We'll pick up where we left off when we come back. Up next, the Pences move to Washington. What does that transition mean for the family? And we can learn about the influence of Karen Pence from the installation of a little red cherry red phone. Ask your questions on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on Mike Pence, I want to tell you about a show we did yesterday on the UAW strike. We talked to a local union leader in Fort Wayne and his son, who works at the nearby plant, about how the strike is affecting them and why they see it as part of a bigger movement for worker unions. Every show we do is available for free wherever you find podcasts, including Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. Just search for All In Indiana. Today, we're talking about the life and career of Vice President and former Indiana Governor Mike Pence. As always, we're taking your questions and comments on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We're live in the studio with Tom LoBianco, political journalist and author of the new Pence bio, Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. So what kind of politician was he in those early days?
He is a cookie-cutter recruit by the House Republicans. He trains at Newt Gingrich's campaign school in 1987 to run for Congress in 1988 and 1990. He doesn't really set a mark for himself in terms of, look, there's a big ideological war going on inside the Republican Party in this moment. 1988, Pat Robertson runs against George H.W. Bush to carry the mantle of Reagan forward. And Robertson represents this sort of this populism, this conservative populism in that moment. Mike Pence doesn't take a side because he's running for Congress and he's focused on himself. So he kind of takes whatever the playbook is and he runs it. And this is where we start to see that he's really good at running playbooks. I mean, literally, I went out and I bought a copy of the manual that he used back then. It's called Flying Upside Down. It was written by a man named Joe Gaylord. He is the top aide to Newt Gingrich, and eventually they lead the Gingrich Revolution in 1994, take over the House for the Republicans. I was reading this book, and it read like all the mailers, all the campaign material, all the reports, everything I had seen about him in the 1988 race. I was like, it was astounding. I couldn't believe it. I was like, Mike Pence is running it by the book, literally. It was so revealing. So look, he loses. He loses twice. He hangs up his hat in 91. He's done. All right. He loses to Phil Sharp. He goes to a conservative think tank. When he's at the conservative think tank, and I report this for the first time in the book. Now, I should say this. It's not the first time it's ever been reported, because this good local reportage, folks like Mary Beth Schneider reported this in the moment in 1992, but I think we kind of lost it to history. Mike Pence became a Pat Buchanan supporter in 92. And remember, these are all the precursors of Donald Trump. This is the conservative populism against the establishment Republicans. He loved Pat Buchanan. There's a great anecdote I report out there for the first time. He faxes a letter to Rush Limbaugh asking him to come do a fundraiser in Indiana for the Indiana Policy Review. It's 1992. And he says he likes him because he's a Pat Buchanan guy that represents conservative values. Please come in to Indy. At the same time, the Bush people are working on Rush Limbaugh, and they get him to switch sides. They say, if we offer you some access to the president, will you please tell everybody to get in line with Bush for the reelection in 92? So Rush Limbaugh does. He switches sides. He switches from Buchanan to H.W. Bush. Pence hates this. He's like, it's a betrayal of conservative values. So he faxes a second letter to Rush Limbaugh, rescinding the invitation. Chuck Quillett, who was the president of the Indiana Policy Review, is in the office, and his sister is listening to the radio, and she's like, Chuck, you got to come over here. There's Russia's destroying Mike Pence right now on air. He's laying into some think tank guy from Indiana who's a nobody, who he doesn't care to go to his event anyway, so he didn't want the invitation to begin with. I mean, it was hilarious. That's his first interaction with Rush Limbaugh.
Wow. Well, eventually, though, persistence pays off.
Yes.
And he becomes the congressman of Indiana's 2nd Congressional District.
Mm-hmm.
And the family moves to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
What is this transition like for the family?
Oh, it's really look, David McIntosh tells him that he ought to move his family to Washington. So they do, right? They pick up and they move to Washington in 2001. It's tough. I mean, basically, you have three young kids, and then in the 90s, his children are born, starting from 1991, Michael Jr., Charlotte, and then Audrey. They're young children. The first big move they actually have to make is from Indianapolis into the congressional district. So they pick up their family in 1999, and they move south to outside of Columbus so they can be in the district. They live there for just a year, basically, and then they move to Washington. His kids are more or less, they're mostly raised in Washington over the next 12 years. That's where they go to high school, graduate out of high school. This is a very formative time for Mike Pence, because this is where his political career takes off. And you see him from 2001 to 2008, he kind of rockets through the ranks of the House of Representatives to eventually to a point where he's at John Boehner's side. Boehner recruits him into the mix and puts him third-ranking House Republican. At the same time, the people you'd call movement conservatives, like Heritage Foundation types, pro-life groups, anti-abortion groups, are also catching on to Mike Pence. And 2008, one of his advisors put it to me this way, and I think this is a really pivotal moment in his career, and this is where we start to see the ambition overtake the principles for him. This is when they capture lightning in a bottle, because you have people coming to him for the first time, seriously, telling him, we want you to run for president against Mitt Romney. They're worried that Mitt Romney is going to pick up the nomination in 2012. All the movement conservatives say, we want you to run for president in 2012 and carry the torch for us, which is very heady. It's very intoxicating to have somebody come to you and say, hey, we want you to carry the torch for this entire movement. This is when his tactics start changing, and he starts seriously kind of reworking things to focus on a White House run. And best I can tell, based on the reporting, that's what he's been doing since 2008, playing a long game, running for the White House.
Let's talk about the telephone.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, sure.
The cherry red telephone
right.
that was on his desk. Mm-hmm. What are we talking about?
So, you know, this actually comes from Dick Armey, the old, I guess he was the House Majority Leader back then, North Dakota, Texas conservative, Republican. Early in Pence's career in Congress, Dick Armey tells him, he's an old hand at that point, and Pence is a freshman. And he tells him, he says, look, you should put a phone on in your office just for your family and give them the number. So that year, Karen buys him a faux antique cherry red telephone, old school telephone. And, you know, when we were covering him when he took office as governor, I think it was Jim Shella asked about this. He pointed to the red telephone that was at the corner of the governor's desk. This might have been inauguration day back in 2013. And he asked him about it. And he asked him specifically because he had heard the stories that Mike Pence had gotten a new office for the second lady, Karen Pence, or for the first lady of Indiana, Karen Pence, right across the hall from his office, which was a very new thing. Sherry Daniels was not very involved in Mitch Daniels' decision making at all. This was a very new dynamic. That phone is become symbolic of the calls. I don't know exactly that they used the red phone. I was told that it was a different phone that they would use. But Karen would actually, according to my sources, would place phone calls from the hall across the hallway to talk with her husband, the governor, about what they were doing. And why do you place a phone call from across the hallway? Because the state house is filled with reporters and lobbyists and lawmakers and people with lots of eyeballs and lots of ears watching to see how things work. And if she walked across the hall, we would all see her. And we would know that she was the one running the show.
Well, we talked about the 2012 presidential run mm-hmm. or potential presidential run, and we see a familiar name here, Kellyanne Conway,
mm-hmm.
who was an aide at the time. She mm-hmm. was in favor of his candidacy in mm-hmm. 2012, but another opportunity comes knocking, coming home to run for governor. We talked a little bit about his days as governor, and this is a fork in the road for mm-hmm. Pence, and so he weighs these options. In what way?
Yeah, it's look, his political career has been supremely cautious, and this is something I saw as I tried to recreate every race that he had run in. The Republican power brokers in this state clear the path for him every time. It starts in 1988. John Sweezy, the old Marion County Republican chairman, clears the field for him for his very first run for Congress. He runs again in 2000. Van Smith, his longtime from Muncie, longtime political advisor, tried to clear the field for Pence in 2000. Ironically enough, Luke Messer was in that race, and he lost that race against Pence in 2000. 2012, what happens, and this is very important to understanding sort of this enmity that develops between House Speaker Brian Bosma and Mike Pence when Pence is governor. A bunch of the big money men around here, people like Fred Klipsch, Bob Grand, if your political types will know these names, general viewers might not know these folks. These are the big donors who run the show in Republican politics around here. They all get together. And they decide that Mike Pence needs to run for governor because Mitch Daniels is running for president. And you can't do both, right? You can't have support both of them. They're going to clear the field. This is in December of 2010. They decide they're going to clear the field of all Republican contenders. So Becky Skillman, the lieutenant governor, is thinking about running. They say, no, you're not going to run. House Speaker Brian Bosma. I mean, the joke here is that every House Speaker thinks they're the governor. And then Bosma wants to be the governor. They tell Bosma he's not going to run. Skillman, you know, nobody's okay with being told they're not going to do something. Skillman takes it better than Bosma. Bosma does not let it go at all. He tells a very bawdy joke in the 2012 Gridiron Dinner about Mike and Karen Pence's sex life. Those of us in the political world kind of knew this. I report it out for the first time in the book, and it's important to understand because Bosma goes too far. I mean, I remember that. It was at the 2012 Gridiron Dinner, and I mean, a lot of drinking. 75% of the room laughs their tuchuses off, and the other 25% gasps.
Oh, my.
And Mike Pence turns pale. I mean, somebody who was watching him in the room, they looked at him, and they're like, God, Mike, are you okay? And he's like, turns pale.
Did he respond at all in that moment?
Yeah, he said, "I don't know. Am I okay?"
Huh.
I mean, the sad thing is, I mean, look, this is... When I'm doing day-to-day journalism, right, and I fall into this trap too, which is we fall into these caricatures of people, right? Oh, he's a theocrat, right? That's who he is. Trump is a political arsonist. That's what he is.
People try to put these labels on.
Yeah. That's not what this is about. It's trying to go deeper to understand. Look at, like, if I could get even 0.001% close to anything that Robert Caro has done. I mean, that's the goal, right? The man behind this just voluminous biography of Lyndon Baines Johnson and Robert Moses. If you can get to the person, you can understand this stuff. Look, when you get to him and understand who he is functionally as a person, don't make the judgment, just try to see where he is. Then things like joining the Trump ticket start to make sense. Now you understand where they're at. Like, and you can cast aside a lot of these. This is just me as a reporter. You can start to cast aside a lot of the BS that's out there. And Lord knows there's a lot of BS in political reporting that we hear from, because the political hacks tell us that on purpose to shape whatever. I was texting with a friend. She made a good point. It's revisionist history. And our goal, it's all of our goals here, is to really get the real history, to understand things. I mean, we're living in this moment right now. He's going to run for president in 2024. So we got to find the human, understand the human, then understand what the tactics are. They all make sense.
Well, let's go back to Pence, the governor.
Sure.
His governorship had its fair share of snags, but nothing exploded quite like RFRA, the mm-hmm. Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Mm-hmm.
How did this legislation that he didn't even write turn into something that might have ended his political career?
Well, you know, the irony is that where I said this enmity between Bosma and Pence, and it was really more one-sided, it was more Bosma angry at Pence being boxed out of running for governor. 2014, let's rewind a second. 2014, the moderate Republicans block a same-sex constitutional marriage ban, that the religious conservatives and social conservatives have been pushing for. So they kind of come up with a consolation prize for the far right wing of the party, and it's this Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It's supposed to protect, allegedly, it's going to protect Christian business owners from having to serve in gay weddings, right?
Among other things.
Yeah. And now the flip side of that is that it also, more than likely, it appears by all readings to allow discrimination in Indiana. It looks like it's legalizing discrimination in Indiana, which is clearly a problem. Mike Pence, in that moment in 2014, doesn't have anything to do with this decision. In fact, he tells one of his advisors he doesn't want anything to do with it. And so the guy who we see as a theocrat is actually telling his advisors that, no, I don't. Let's let the Supreme Court decide. I'm not going to stick my head out and have it chopped off politically if the high court's going to decide anyway.
That is so fascinating, because here in Indiana, it just seemed like he was the face of this. And sort of, when it came out, he just sort of owned it.
Well, the irony of this, and this goes to his political tactics, there's a supreme irony in this for Pence in his career and how he kind of handles things. Well, I noticed this when he was governor. He would swoop in at the last minute to take credit for bills, whether he had a hand in them or not. And, I mean, is it that surprising for a politician to come in and take credit for something they had nothing to do with? I mean, so he swoops in, he does what he always does. He swoops in at the last minute on this bill, the RFRA bill. In March of 2015, he had nothing to do with the creation of this legislation. It's a Brian Bosma product. Bosma made that bill. It's a consolation prize. And Pence sticks his finger in the wind, and he's like, okay, nobody's protesting this. I can give a hand here to my Christian right friends, and we'll do a big bill signing, and we'll have some photos of it, but we're not going to have the press invited into this. It'll be private, but I'll take some credit for it. Was that Thursday, March 26, 2015, when he does this. I mean, you could never have foreseen this. George Takei, Mr. Sulu from Star Trek, writes this Facebook post about how terrible Mike Pence is for signing this bill, because he knows exactly what this bill is, because his family had been in the internment camps. And it's just like this Facebook post blows up. And it sparks a viral cultural moment that engulfs Mike Pence. And yeah, Mike Pence is the face of this thing because he made a decision to be the face of this thing. He stuck his head out of the bunker, decided he would get a political win out of it, and it politically blows up in his face. And it's, I mean, it's kind of ironic, right? Because that's not how he'd been. His operations blow up in his face. His tactics do not work in this moment.
And then, of course, we have the TV interview with George Stephanopoulos. Mm-hmm. After that interview, which was pretty disastrous in the last 30 seconds that we have, was he still then thinking about running for president? His career seemed to be over.
Yeah, that was it. That, by all counts, his career seemed to be over. You know, look, nobody running for president, they were worried about running for re-election. They didn't even know if he was going to run for re-election.
Lots to talk about today with Tom LoBianco, author of Piety and Power, a biography of Vice President Mike Pence. We'll be back with Tom after the break. And up next, we'll talk more about the moment that Mike Pence shifts from a governor on the ropes to the candidate for vice president and the moment when Trump comes knocking. We'll talk about what kind of vice president Mike Pence is. That's coming up next. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back now to our discussion on Vice President Mike Pence. We're joined by Tom LoBianco, author of Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. So how did Mike Pence get on Donald Trump's radar?
Yeah. Paul Manafort and Reince Priebus, Paul Manafort campaign chairman and Reince Priebus, Republican Party chairman, really wanted Mike Pence to be the running mate for Trump. Trump, this is what, June of 2016, Trump really did not like Mike Pence. It all starts with somebody who Trump does like from Indiana. His name is Stephen Hilbert. And to your folks who've been around for a little bit, and to, I guess I'll explain this for the younger crowd. He used to be the owner of Conseco Insurance, a big name. He's a billionaire, had a gigantic mansion up in Carmel, as I recall. It's the one that Forrest Lucas owns now. Hilbert is good friends with Trump from the 90s because from the casino industry, and they worked together on some business when Trump was doing the riverboats out here. And June of 2016, Stephen Hilbert sends a text message to Mike Pence, and he says, it's like passing notes between kids in middle school, right? You know, if you were to be considered for running mate for Donald Trump, would you say yes? And it's like, and there's a reason behind this, because a lot of people are saying no. A lot of Republicans are saying no, because in this moment, they see Trump as toxic.
Yeah, it was that kind of a moment in the 2016 campaign.
Yeah, at that point, it's before Trump has really kind of taken over the Republican Party. There's still a lot of, it's not never Trumpers. People just don't want anything to do with them. Pence and Mike and Karen Pence pray about it, and they say yes, and this starts the vetting process. Paul Manafort and Reince Priebus want him to be the running mate because it will help a lot of problems down ballot. It will help them electorally. It brings more conservatives and quiet evangelical voters, not the televangelist. And remember, understand Mike's faith. The vice president's faith is to understand the politics as well, because the televangelist types were already on board with Trump. You didn't need to bring them back into the fold. They were there. Mike Pence brings in your quiet Midwestern, non-denominational evangelicals. This is and ultimately really helps move the needle on election day. So Chris Christie is a favorite for Trump himself, but Jared Kushner, who's the real power behind the throne, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, like Newt Gingrich. It's kind of ironic because Pence starts at Gingrich's campaign school in 1987, and here he is running against Gingrich for the running mate 30 years later. It starts with a flat tire on July 12th, 2016. The flat tire, the Trump campaign plane pops a flat tire here in Indianapolis. It forces Trump, it strands Trump in Indianapolis, and it forces him to pay more attention to Mike Pence. I report this in the book for the first time. The next morning, Wednesday, July 13th, they have breakfast at the governor's mansion. We all know about this. What we did not know about before, and I have it here for the first time, is that they have a meeting in the governor's basement, and the furnished basement, the bunker, and Trump sits down across from Mike Pence, and it's brass tacks time. And he asks him, he says, Mike, I need killers. Are you going to be a killer? Like, Chris Christie wants this. He's a killer. He's calling me all the time about this. And Pence is very calm because of his faith, his very preternatural calm to him. He's like, I'm not a killer. I don't need this. I'll be your lobbyist in Congress. I will help you fundraise. I will bring evangelicals back into the fold. But I don't need this. I'm running for re-election. And Trump is just astounded by this. So Trump looks at him. He says, why don't you want this? You know, everyone else has fallen all over themselves for this thing. And Pence looks at him. And this is I think this is where the Irish Catholic comes in. He grabs the moment and he smiles and he says, well, to be honest, sir, you're sitting in my home and my house and your whole family is here. Why do you want me? Huh. And Trump is astounded. But this does not seal the deal. I'm just going to tease this here. I'm terrible at teasing things. But let me just tease this, okay? Because you got to buy the book. This opens the door for Mike Pence, and Trump does call him that night and offer it to him. But this is not what actually gets him the vice presidency and the spot on the ticket. That happens 2 days later. Got to pick up the book. It's more pedestrian than that. That's what actually, there's something else that's very crafty, which gets him the VP spot.
Well, so now Mike Pence and Donald Trump are on the official ticket.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Until the Access Hollywood tape.
Yes, yes.
And there was genuine talk that for the good of the party, the Republican Party, the ticket needed to change after that. What decision is Pence then faced with?
Friday, October 7th, 2016, was 4 p.m. The Washington Post publishes now famous Access Hollywood tapes where Donald Trump talks of his prowess in molesting women. This is astounding, even by Trump standards. Within a few hours, Republican donors start calling up Pence's chief political aide, telling him that the Republican Party is ready to remove Trump from the ticket and replace him with Pence. And they don't even have to do anything. They don't even have to say yes. But they say no. And here's the reason why. And this is really important to understanding where he is now and how he's operating now. They've already made a decision. The Pence team has already made a decision that they're running when Trump loses. Everyone expects Trump to lose in November, 1 month, 30 days. Once he loses, he becomes the front runner for the Republican nomination in 2020. And it's gravy, right? Politically, that's all you have to do, survive 4 months with Donald Trump. And this is part of the calculation that they do in deciding to say yes to Trump. Survive 4 months with Donald Trump, and you get to the front of the pack. You go from potentially losing a governor's race to maybe becoming the nominee for president and having a shot at winning the presidency in 2020. So, look, I've heard these stories out there, and I've seen it published that Pence was part of a coup attempt. But like I said earlier, put everything in context and go deep and understand the human and how he works, and none of that made sense. He's not plotting a coup attempt. Why would he plot a coup attempt? Trump's going to lose in 30 days. Like, he doesn't need to plot a coup attempt. It's the same calculation that Mitch McConnell makes. Mitch McConnell stops some of this talk too. And he's the reason why is because McConnell knows that Trump's going to lose in 30 days. You don't have to, you know, stick the knife in politically. There's no point in doing that. And why would you do that anyway? You're going to anger the Trump political base. So they're thinking down the road. So that's why they stick with Trump. And it's also why they stick with Trump now. Fundamentally, that's what it's about.
Fast forward to the night of the election.
Mm-hmm.
In your book, this section is titled "The Complications of Winning."
Yes.
What were those complications?
Well, so what was the plan? The plan was Trump loses, they win. So 1:30 a.m., Hillary Clinton calls to concede to Donald Trump. And Wednesday, November 9th, 1:30 a.m., and Mike Pence turns around to Karen and he says, "We did it." And Karen looks at him and she says, she rebuffs his kiss. He tries to go in for a kiss and she rebuffs him and says,
"Ouch.
You got what you wanted, Mike. Now leave me alone."
Wow.
And when I first heard this story, I thought to myself that she was angry at Trump because he's such, you know, a very unchristian man, let's put it that way. And the more I reported this, the more I realized that she was angry at Mike because he had just screwed up their political career, their joint political career, with this decision. And it was a gamble to spend 4 months. It seemed like such a bright idea at the time. And when they won, When Trump won, they lost, because now it moved from being a decision of living with Trump for 4 months to living with him for at least 4 years.
And not to mention they're now forever tied.
Yes.
With him.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. It fundamentally retrains his image. Look, what's happening now? This Saturday Night Live caricatures of him, where he's like they paint him as a toady to Trump. This picture would not exist if Trump had lost. And it's just politically damaging. And I don't know that you ever wash something like that off. I don't know that you can. I mean, once you've been parodied on Saturday Night Live, I think that's it. I think that is set in the public mindset.
Well, we hear rumors, though, that Pence is secretly running the show at the White House.
Yeah.
And then others say he's nothing more than a glorified coat rack.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you fall on this?
He's in the middle. He's not like, and again, this is to the, political hacks use this stuff on us reporters all the time because, it's interesting, it's sexy, it sells stuff. It's not accurate, though. I mean, look, he's not the shadow president. He's not secretly running anything. He's also not just there, right? Like that elf on the shelf moment in the Schumer, Pelosi, and Trump meeting. He has a lane, all right? He has social conservative policy, the anti-abortion, religious freedom, the national RFRA stuff, and also health and human services. He's able to get some people appointed to key spots within the agency, but he doesn't control every major appointment. He's not supremely powerful, and I think, and this also goes to his relationship with Trump. He doesn't push Trump. He doesn't actively fight him on anything. And ironically enough, I think it was when John Bolton, they were talking about, I forget exactly what they were talking about. It was, I think, something regarding Iran. And they put Pence out there. Some of the White House people, most likely Bolton's people, put out that Pence was involved in this too. And Pence goes back on Twitter and says, no way, fake news. It's all lies. I wouldn't do that. I believe Pence because does not actively fight Trump, because why would you do that? The people who actively fight Trump get fired. And guess what? Mike Pence could get fired because he could get fired, not put back on the ticket in 2020. Right?
Well, it's interesting to think about the impeachment inquiry today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the implications it has for Pence, because we've been through a similar game of what if during the Russia mm-hmm. investigation. And if it came to it, does Pence even want to be the default president, or does he want to earn it on his own merit?
Oh, they want to earn it in their own right. Absolutely. Yeah. Everyone that I talk to in his orbit, his advisors, they don't want to be Gerald Ford. They want to be George H.W. Bush. They want to win it after two consecutive terms of Trump riding on the coattails, and then have Ford, if you're Ford, you're a president with an asterisk. If you're H.W. Bush, you're president. If you're one term, whatever, but you've won the presidency in your own right. Now, look, he's exposed in the Ukraine thing. As Trump himself pointed out last week at the UN press conference, he says, maybe you should ask for Mike Pence's tapes. He did have a meeting with President Zelensky. He talked about this corruption battle, which, it, depending upon how you read it, could be code for, investigating Joe Biden. He's exposed in a way that he was not in the Mueller probe. And that it might be the most perilous position that he's been in this presidency.
So it sounds like Trump's almost trying to sabotage Pence.
He wrapped his arms around him in that press conference last week and said, you should ask for his tapes. And I think that.
But he's also a showman.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We know from the reporting and from most examples that loyalty is a one-way street with Trump. And Pence is unflinchingly loyal. The irony of people talking about this, I did this after I finished the book. I wrote a story for Yahoo News all about how Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump have been talking about replacing Mike Pence on the ticket. And I should point out that there are people who say this is false, that's not true, fake news, et cetera. They've been talking about it because they want somebody who can help Trump win re-election. And you see this in these loyalty tests. Some of Pence's supporters call them loyalty tests. It's, you send them out to a border detention camp in the middle of July where these migrant men in cages. And it's just this terrible scene. And I had, you know, one Pence ally in particular tell me that should have been the president down there. That shouldn't have been Mike Pence in that. But they can do that. You can still yank on the leash, so to say, because he's not guaranteed the spot on the ticket. Now, look, Trump says all the time that he's the pick for the ticket, but that's not how the Pence team acts. They act as though they're still in jeopardy, and that's a really important tell.
In the book, you write, quote, "The closer Mike Pence got to becoming president, the more he seemed to lose himself. Mm-hmm. Standing with Trump had forced him to flip-flop on his most core principles, with the distinct exception of his opposition to abortion."
Mm-hmm.
Negative campaigning, presidential philandering, profligate federal spending, free trade, he bent completely to Trump's positions that stood opposite his, end quote. And they're fascinating biblical allegories that some have mm-hmm. drawn to this partnership between Pence and Trump. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what those are?
Two Old Testament stories that his friends told me, and they help explain this. One is the story of Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. The Israelites are in exile in Babylon. Daniel's a Jewish slave. Nebuchadnezzar is a tyrant, casts the Jewish exiles into these, you know, killing them, murdering them. God works through Daniel to protect his people while they're in exile. That's under the tyrant. The other one is Joseph and the Pharaoh. We were over at Marion University yesterday, and they're going to be putting on a production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. You can
classic,
right? You can see Donny Osmond do this story, right?
Sure.
That's another allegory that they tell too, and it's in functionally what this is. If you pull back, right, they don't take it literally, but these are ways of understanding the relationship. It's that they see Mike Pence keeping the country on track and protecting his people from the flip side, then the second part of that is from a tyrant, functionally, at the end of the day. It's about keeping things on track. So this is how they explain. How do you explain this? How do you explain him standing by the guy who had sex with Stormy Daniels while, his wife's pregnant, third wife is pregnant with their child? That's how, because he's keeping the country on track.
Let's come back to today. Let's say nothing comes of the impeachment inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
Mitch McConnell has said we won't remove him from office. You know, Trump remains for the full term, which it looks like he probably will. Mm-hmm. Is Pence still going to run for president in the future?
Yeah, 2024 is the number. It's almost irregardless. I'm sorry. Terrible. I hate irregardless, and I still say it.
I think they both work, don't they? Isn't that the conclusion? Regardless and irregardless.
Right. Regardless of the answer. 2024 is the political answer for them. And the reason why is because, look, I was talking with a Trump advisor last week who made a really great point. Mike Pence right now as vice president can be everybody's friend. Starting the day after the election, regardless of whether Trump wins or loses, in 2020, November 2020, he is running for president in 2024, and he has to start making decisions. So regardless of what happens in this election, they're focused on 2024.
Tom Lobianco, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Matt.
The book is Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Maggie Galon, Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross and Chris Flood. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we look at Indiana's famous fall foliage. 1 million people visit Brown County every fall. How does the local community deal with the deluge of tourists this time of year? And what kinds of trees make up the majority of Indiana's colorful forests? We'll talk to the public relations coordinator for the Brown County Convention and Visitors Bureau and the chief naturalist for Brown County State Park. That's tomorrow at 1. You can send us your questions and comments on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.